My name's Rob Landley. I used to maintain BusyBox, and I do all sorts of weird things with embedded software. This is Garrett Klimovich. Now you actually know how to pronounce the vowel-less last name. He did UC Lib C++.
It's an embedded C++ library, once again designed, obviously, for embedded systems, implemented from scratch, currently under LGPL, but somebody's been telling me that that's not equally suitable. And
LGPL is fine.
Yeah, but they make enough arguments.
Why do they think it's not legally right?
Because the STL stuff that are in the headers gets incorporated into the code, and so it actually should be GPL with exceptions. And
no, LGPL. Worry about it later.
Yeah.
So anyway, we used to work together at a company called TimeSys, and we actually knew each other before that, so we've been doing embedded software development on Linux for fun for many years. You know, I'm doing a talk at Audible Linux Symposium on this later. I got flown to California last year for the Consumer Electronic Linux Forum. So we do this for fun. Now, I'd like to know what the program book actually says we're going to be talking about, because there's way more than we could possibly fit in an hour, so I'd like a little focus.
Ladies and gentlemen, this would be a very good idea.
Introduction. It says introduction to open source embedded.
Is that actually what the flavor text afterwards says?
No, that's the title.
What's the flavor text? I know what the title is.
World with more cell phones than laptops.
Oh, that. I wrote that. Right. okay. Interesting thing about cell phones. Linux is finally starting to penetrate in cell phones. The biggest competitor to a Linux company like TimeSys or MonaVista or whoever the other one is, Wind River, the biggest competitor to those guys isn't actually any proprietary operating system. It's the roll-your-own stuff. It's the guys who get some hardware and go, I'm going to write my own operating system in assembly for this thing. And they write something about as complicated as DOS that gets them to a point they can ship it. And that's always been something like 80% of the market.
About 5 or 6 years ago, there was a major shift in the market. A lot of people were saying, well, we're spending all of this time writing our own operating system for something that runs on ARM or possibly MIPS. But there's Linux out there which runs on ARM and MIPS, and it provides all of the core level stuff that we need, that we can bolt our, you know, Java runtime environment or our core supporting libraries on it. And almost overnight, this entire group of people just suddenly shifted over to working with Linux. So it's been probably one of the single largest increases in the Linux user base in terms of devices shipped in a single instance.
There are millions of little embedded devices. There are more cell phones than laptops. There are all those little Linksys routers ship hundreds of thousands of units in any given quarter. And essentially, it's sort of a huge dark mask because you don't really hear about it that much and you don't really see that it's running Linux. When Linux started creeping into the embedded space, this was around 1999 is when people first started seriously going, well, can I poke there? It had some problems. Battery life. You don't want to wake up the system every clock tick, and you don't want to have, you know, a lot of the various demons, you know, kernel threads that run in the background, sitting there eating CPU because, well, your battery has to last a long time. A cell phone, if it's to have 2 weeks of standby time with a given battery, I believe the standard is that it has to work on 5 milliwatts when it's in standby. And based on that, it has to periodically sample from the cell tower, hey, is anybody trying to call me so I can ring? This is not much. You really can't do anything. You've got to quiesce the hell out of the system and do nothing. But the really strange part is the ultra low end, they want the power consumption down. The ultra high end also wants the power consumption down because they're worried about heat. They're worried about clustering. They're worried about density. Every watt you consume generates heat in a 1-to-1 ratio. Heat is power. Power is heat. So the high-end people are worried about their air conditioning bill and how much they can cram into a given amount of very expensive rack space. So they're working on things like the tickless kernel and things like, you know, using less memory, and can we have a diskless system so that's one less component in there so we can get more dense systems. So the systems that don't actually have a hard drive and might actually want to remove the block layer, the embedded people love this kind of thing because it's like, hey, we can rip more stuff out. We can use less DRAM. There are a bunch of system-on-a-chip things that it's like, okay, here's an ARM processor core, 2 megs of flash, and 4 megs of DRAM.
One of the examples I want to talk about actually is the gum sticks. I don't know if anybody here has heard of it. It is essentially something the size of a stick of gum. It contains an ARM processor, typically a couple megs of flash, and I think the ones that they're shipping now contain 16 megs of RAM. What this means now is that where embedded systems typically contain 1 to 2 orders magnitude less RAM just in order to cut down cost, power consumption, and so forth, it's now to the point that something the size of a stick of gum can have your processor and 16 megs of RAM, and you can fit a lot of Linux into 16 megs of RAM. It's even to the point now that they don't even want to try bother shrinking it down anymore because
your Ethernet connector is so big.
Well, it's not even that. I mean, just the cost of production now for RAM chips is to the point that going smaller actually starts costing you more. Because the predominant cost at this point is just basically producing an IC. And
if I remember correctly, they were repurposing SIMS as their motherboard.
No, SIMS are too thick.
What were they repurposing then?
They may have started off on SIMS, but the new stuff is actually smaller than that and thinner.
I had a laptop SIMS?
I'm not sure. I know I had a devil of a time trying to find a screw small enough that I could bolt it to something so it wouldn't slide away. Something the size of a full pack of gum, you can have keyboard, mouse, Ethernet, processor, a hunk of flash, a hunk of RAM. And when you've got all of those, you've basically got a full system, you know, that you can literally hold in the palm of your hand. And that's another thing that has driven Linux adoption, is because now you don't have to worry about, well, I really need to save that extra 20K so that we can have the clock application we need to worry about.
People who program in assembly are expensive.
Yes. Well, they're expensive, and the output that you get for the amount of money you put in is incredibly small.
It turns out that whatever your language is, a good programmer who's familiar with the language in a good working environment gets in the groove, produces approximately the same lines of code per day. It varies in order of magnitude, at least between programmers, but a given programmer will produce about as many finished lines of code a day in assembly, C, or Python. So if you have a language like Python where you can write an entire fully functional web server in 200 lines that does does a lot, or you can write in the same amount of time, you can write, finish, and debug 200 lines of C, or you can write 200 lines of assembly that may actually be able to print 2 characters on the screen. Choose your poison.
Yeah, but think of the efficiency.
Oh, yeah. The embedded space isn't really doing a whole lot with things like Python. They keep trying to shoehorn Perl in there. There's ranges of embedded systems. If you have more than about 64 megs of memory, of DRAM, I don't particularly consider that too seriously in an embedded system. By that point, you're getting a pretty powerful system. You don't have to get too fancy about embeddedness.
I'll talk about that later.
Yeah. Down to about 16 megs is where you start have to actually, you know, 16 megs of DRAM is where you actually have to start paying attention to things and doing things like glibc isn't a very good fit anymore. You want to use uclibc. And then 8 megs of RAM, you have to really pay attention. And 4 megs is where you start doing things like, you know, I may want a no-MMU system because I can't afford to waste memory on page tables. You know, you can work in 4 megs of memory. Working in 2 megs is theoretically possible, but I don't know anybody who's doing it. That's DRAM. DRAM is one constraint. DRAM is your volatile memory that you're loaded into, that's not your storage. Your storage these days is generally flash. Can be other things, but generally flash. Your flash is what you boot from. In an embedded system, your ROM essentially is generally in flash. Your bootloader is generally in flash. Your kernel image is often in flash, and you often have a file system image in flash. Now, you can have an init RAMFS built into the kernel. It's essentially a CPIO archive that gets that gets extracted into a RAMFS during the boot process. This replaced initRD because it's actually noticeably more efficient in a number of detailed internal ways that we could go into if we had time, but we don't really. But when you spec out an embedded system, generally what you're going to spec out is how much memory do I have, how much storage do I have, how much flash do I have, or whatever other storage you're going to be using. They can net boot, but usually only do that for testing, or the high-end clusters. What kind of processor do I have? And a lot of times you're going to be using something like a 233 megahertz ARM processor. Yes, they come faster, but that is very low power consumption.
One of the things that has made Linux made this a lot easier is, sadly, when you start dealing with embedded devices, frequently you will have a hardware team that's going to sit down and decide everything that you're going to use, and then a software team. And you run into a problem very early on if you're not using a portable operating system that the software people really can't start the work that they're working on until the hardware people have finished so they can start writing code.
Or at least gotten them a prototype.
Yeah, well, you need a prototype or you need an emulator or something to that effect. With a portable OS like Linux, what you're able to do is the hardware...
Prototype it on Intel.
You can prototype the software on Intel, and the hardware people basically can choose from almost anything. ARM, does it run Linux? Good enough. PowerPC, pick a chip, whatever. Does it run Linux? Yes, done.
Sometimes partway through you'll find that your supplier has ended production on that line. Don't He tried to buy a board from VIA. By the time we got the purchasing authority to buy a board that we'd spec'd out, they'd stopped making that particular board how many times in a row?
They'd stopped making that board. By the time we decided we wanted that one, they had stopped making that one and made another one which was comparable, which we then sent up as a purchasing order, but by the time they looked at the purchasing order, that one had been phased out. So we had to send them another board number, and then they approved that. But between the time they approved it and we bought it, they discontinued that one. I think we went through five different board models.
Yeah.
Fast pace of development really sucks when you're trying to get something approved for purchase.
Linksys routers. Some of them have an ARM processor. Some of them have a MIPS processor. It was whatever was cheapest for that production run. ARM is sort of the 800-pound gorilla in this space, because it has the best power-to-performance ratio. Now, in the desktop space, everybody's talking about price-to-performance. That's important in the embedded space, but what else is important is power consumption to performance. With ARM, you get the most bang for the watt. MIPS is close, and MIPS has some other advantages. MIPS is more flexible if you want to make a system on a chip where you're integrating controllers for various other peripherals on the same chip. MIPS is more easily designed to mix and match parts and then fab your own chips.
Another nice thing about ARM, too, that I want to mention is, for embedded devices, ARM is physically a very small processor.
43,000 transistors
in
the core. That's it.
Which is minuscule by today's production standards. So you're able to use older fabs, and this is definitely an issue for people designing things like cell phones or MP3 players. I mean, form factor becomes an issue when it's not bolted down in a server room. Okay, I mean, you can always add another 2U to whatever appliance it is that, you know, pisses off the people responsible for shipping, but it doesn't really matter.
Modern desktop processors, they're bolting a heat sink on there that you could probably kill someone with if you got a really good swing in there.
I hadn't thought of that. Good one.
This basically means that they've overclocked the chips, and they would go with water cooling if they thought they could get away with it. Intel started overclocking its own processors. The 386 was the last processor you could run that didn't need a heatsink. All the 486s, as far as I know, needed heatsinks, and since about the 586, they've needed fans on top of the heatsinks. It just gets more and more that, you know, they're pushing the envelope of performance because that's what they cared about. You know, they're upping the voltage, they're really pushing a lot of extra stuff in there, and they need to get the heat to go away. In almost any embedded device, you can't afford a fan. You don't want the moving part, you don't want the extra power consumption, you don't want something sucking dust in there to get in there and screw things up.
Space.
You want no moving parts. And the other thing is that, where did that heat come from? Suppose that you have a battery-powered space heater. Okay, that's essentially just, you know, you get the heat out anyway. You'd just like it to do work first. Okay, well, I mean, your battery-powered space heater, how long's the battery going to last? You're not going to hook it up to a car battery. So you don't want a battery-powered space heater. If you have a heat sink, even without a fan, you have bigger problems. The battery's going to die immediately. So you want something like ARM where it's cool to the touch when it runs. You know, that's because it's working off of what would be trickle current for a modern, you know, PC. Now, actually, laptops have been outselling desktops since 2005. So, the you know, Intel and AMD have started to care about this stuff because, well, more people have laptops. You know, I mean, you can take a laptop and hook it up to a flat screen monitor and a keyboard in a docking station and use that as your PC. And as the unit volumes of laptops get higher and higher, the cost of the components gets lower and lower. Essentially, the old desktop form factor is going away. When people talk about blade servers, that means how can we use laptop components in the server room?
Actually, talking about the server room is something that I sort of want to talk a bit about. When we think of embedded, traditionally you think of how small and lightweight and power efficient can you get something. Historically, that's been the case because you want to get something into a small amount of memory. But what this has led to is much smaller code. And as I've mentioned previously, you know, the amount of RAM that you can throw on the lowest end system you can get nowadays is outrageously large by embedded system. Historically, what's been available on embedded systems, 16 megs now minimum is basically what you're looking at if you're trying.
Unless you're doing system on a chip when they have less.
Well, yeah, but even still, that happens, but that's not as big as it used to be. What is becoming a big issue?
Actually, systems are going to keep getting smaller. I have a dream.
Oh, no.
Imagine Captain Crunch boxes when you're going down the grocery aisle, and the display is changing every 30 seconds on the front of the Captain Crunch box because they have a printed display on the cardboard with a little tiny chip in one quarter powered by one of those batteries that makes LEDs blink on a CD or something, or in the little blinky rings you get.
And it's still going to come with 128 megs of RAM on board.
But if that has to work 6 months off a watch battery and be so cheap that you throw it out, okay, and that is going to have unit volume, in about 10 years, that's going to have unit volumes in the hundreds of millions per product line. Okay, you had a question.
Yeah, I hear you talking about two different classes of systems here. So can you give me an example of a battery-powered Linux-based product?
Well, these days cell phones are starting to switch to Linux. This just happened. Essentially, it's happening this year. The plans for it gelled last year. I've heard rumblings from like four different manufacturers, and they're all under NDA.
My laptop?
His laptop is battery-powered Linux.
My laptop, but it's not an embedded system. It's a general-purpose computer.
That's true.
Let's talk about what distinguishes a general-purpose system from an embedded system. It's not just the size, because as we've mentioned, some of these really high-end, powerful clustering systems have a lot of the properties of embedded systems. Embedded systems fundamentally don't have a keyboard and a monitor in regular use. That's one of the big things.
The company I currently work for is called Network Appliance. They're a Fortune 500 company, and they produce high-performance storage systems. So when you want to store terabytes of data, and you want it really, really fast, you give us lots and lots of money. What makes that an embedded system, despite the fact that we have multiple CPUs with like 32 gigs of RAM in the system and more hard drive space than anybody will probably use in their entire lifetime, is that the core system image is not designed to be changed on a regular basis. It's not, you know, you install an image on it, and it stays there.
And it's also special purpose. It's performing a task.
Yep.
There is something that it does. You don't load general purpose application software on this. It does a thing, and that's what it's for.
Who runs Windows Update on their microwave?
I mean,
Microsoft. Windows everywhere. Landfills, septic tanks.
That's a new one. Good.
That's actually a very old one. Automobiles. Linux is showing up in automobiles. Generally using the Super Hitachi processor, Super H, you may have heard of it. It's a processor that's almost unknown in this country because it came from Japan and it's used widely in Japan. And what does Japan do? They make cars. Okay? It's very widely used in the automotive industry.
Your typical current model of your automobile has 20 to 30 embedded systems in it.
Yep.
Maybe one of which will be running Linux or comparable.
Oh, yeah.
Zero.
I'm not saying that.
Zero.
Keep in mind that embedded Linux started in 1999. Before then, there essentially wasn't any. Okay? So we're not quite 10 years from this technology's introduction. It is now in the, depending on what product range you're talking about, I would have to double check the figures. I'm pretty sure that we're not yet shipping a billion of all the devices that are out there. I don't think we're yet shipping a billion per year with Linux. I think we are shipping 100 million per year with Linux, though.
The other thing too is just because not everything runs Linux doesn't necessarily mean it's not important. I mean, as you get more and more special purpose dealing with particular applications, there may be cases where they want to avoid that. I mean, if I was personally designing something like that, I'd integrate all into one system, but that's because I'm a sadomasochist. Central point of failure, it's really great. You know, general car fault. As long as you're going to keep all of this separated into, as you mentioned, 23 different microcontrollers, you're going to avoid doing something like that. But at that point, I would guess that they're going away from processor-based systems to controller-based systems.
I'm more familiar with what they do with airplanes and fighter jets and stuff rather than automotive. But in a lot of that, they have embedded Lisp. And they have all these weird feedback loops that they've worked out. It's its own specialization.
Yeah.
And a lot of this stuff, I mean, it gets into rapid real-time control. Okay? People are always talking about, oh, yes, you've got to put the control rods in the nuclear reactor in really quick. Yeah, well, your brake system kind of has to work in real-time, too. You know, if your brake system decides, give me 2 seconds, that could be bad.
I recently had the brakes fail on my car.
Cell phones. Cell phones are very easy to show as an example of everybody has one, more or less, more than 50% of the population. It's something that has to last a long time off of a single battery. You want 2 weeks of standby time is the average for the industry. And it's something that is very demanding on real time because if the system goes out to lunch for a tenth of a second, you get a detectable audio dropout. And you want to avoid that, okay? It's got two things it's doing simultaneously. It's receiving a signal and playing it back to you as audio, and then it's digitizing an outgoing signal and transmitting it back. You've got networking, breaking down data into packets and sending it through a network. You've got audio capture, you've got audio playback in real time. And then it's got all the weird little things it's doing behind the scenes for power management and figuring out whether or not it has to give you a low battery beep and just general administrative stuff. That's actually fairly complicated. Okay? Some of it can be done by dedicated support chips. Some of it you can do in hardware. And whether it's cheaper to have more functionality in hardware versus more functionality in software is something the industry has seesawed about on every time it's come up. Do you solve this problem in hardware? Do you solve this problem in software? In the long run, doing it in software gives you faster turnaround times, and it gives you more flexibility. And in anything that you have to do, in anything where shorter cycles gets your product out before the competition, it tends to migrate to software. And one of the nice things, I mean, Linux in cell phones is new. It's something people have kind of been poking at for a while, but actually deploying it is the past 18 months or so is when people have really started to take that seriously. And some of the reasons for that, Linux can work on multiple processors, so you're not actually tied down to ARM or MIPS or PowerPC was big here for political reasons, because Motorola was part of the Apple-IBM-Motorola alliance, so before Motorola spun off Freescale, they were trying to do the process. Well, Motorola is weird. Most people have not invented here, and Motorola has can't invented here. We'd need Piggy on the panel to really talk about that. Yeah. He used to work for Motorola. But there's a lot of things that have to be solved simultaneously. You have to get the memory consumption down. You have to get the size of your stored image down to where it can fit in Flash. You want to get the complexity of the whole system down, not just the size of your kernel, but the size of the code you're running in user space, not just for storage, but for security reasons.
Thank you. And on that hook, I've been trying to jump in here for a moment. One of the big things that has come out of embedded with smaller amounts of code is that you have much more auditable code. Okay, it's much easier to be able to put something like UCLibC in a system or BusyBox in a system because the total number of lines of code is
in a secure system.
Well, in a secure system, but is going to be an order or two magnitude less. I mean, even ignoring the final binary size, it allows. First of all, when you're going to be deploying a system, you want to make sure that you're not going to have to go back and do some kind of recall on it because of faulty hardware or software. If you're lucky, you can do flash upgrades. So you want something that you can go through and have confidence in that it's going to work. You also get smaller binary out of that too, which is nice. And security auditing now is becoming a big issue. I mean, the fact that Bruce Schneier is somebody that most people here will know the name of is an indication that security has become a much bigger concern in our day-to-day lives as product developers.
Well, this is a non-standard audience.
Well, yeah, but, you know.
One of the weirdest moments in my life was when I found out I was maintaining BusyBox, and I found out that BusyBox was being used to run the display at NORAD. I'm going, and they went, oh yeah, see, we can read every line and audit it.
Yep.
Can't do that with GNU stuff. It took them 833 lines to implement cat. That's what got me into BusyBox development in the first place. I made the mistake of reading the source code to some of the GNU tools, and I went, what? No. 65 lines. 833.
That's one of the things that I focused on with my embedded C++ library as well. When I started it, I was, you know, how can I shave the extra, you know, pointer out of this? How can I save an extra 2 bytes here, an extra 3 bytes there? And though I'm still concerned about space, I've switched over to being more concerned.
Simplicity
and auditability. Because, you know, as we brought up before, you can always afford an extra 5 bytes of RAM. You can't afford a security hole. And it's actually starting to scare me, the number of people that I have writing me telling me that they're using my stuff, because I just don't trust anything I ever write. But apparently people are starting to actually look at it and say, hey, you've got something I can read. It's straightforward. It involves large amounts of self-code reuse. We're going to throw it in some routers that we're developing. I've got some people using it for wireless routers, some people doing some classified stuff. Okay.
The thing about a cell phone or a Linksys router or something like that, hooked up to some kind of network, live, real time, is you start to get what's called a Warhol worm. A Warhol worm is something that could theoretically spread to every potentially infectable system in 15 minutes.
Sapphire.
Where basically what you do is you partition the IPv4 space, the IPv6 space or something, and each of the worms intelligently picks a subset so that rather than just randomly sending it out, they branch out and, you know, coordinate somehow. I'm not going to go into too much detail, but I'm sure you can figure it out.
It's
like, how long would it take to partition the IPv4 space and ping every potentially infected system once?
It's already happened. The SQL, what was it, Slammer or Sapphire, whatever they were calling it.
There was one that went after a firewall. Hmm. And another thing that we've been wondering for years is why there hasn't been a virus that formats hard drives. It's just, apparently because there's money in botnets is one of the big things. But there was an example of this thing that just went after firewall systems. It only went after a security program. But it went after firewalls, and what it did is it would send out 65,000 attempts to infect, and then it would pick one random sector of the hard drive and erase it. And then it would loop. So by the time it actually brought the system down by punching random holes in your hard drive, all your files were moth-eaten. It was actually worse than erasing everything, because if it had just erased everything, then it's gone and there's no more work to be done. You either back up to your most recent backup, or you know, cry and move on. But now it's like, oh, I have this huge forensic nightmare that maybe there's something salvageable here. I don't know. The system won't reboot long before it goes down. It was just vicious. You know, and this is probably by no means the worst thing they could have done to the system. Generally, if you have a system that's infected with a rootkit, reinstall. Trying to salvage a system that's infected with a rootkit is a way out there specialty, because there's so many different ways to hide something nasty. I sort of know what's involved, and I know just enough to know that I don't want to go there. Modern systems are very, very complex. I mean, your average Linux distro. I mean, Fedora boots from like 5 CDs, or needs 5 CDs to install. Ubuntu installs from 1, but have you ever tried installing it without network access? It's a little unhappy. Okay? It's a lot of code. Remember when CDs were so flippin' huge? It's like, wow, 600 megs. When they first started mastering CDs, the hard part was getting enough hard drive space to store an ISO image. Circa 92 or something. Now it's like, oh, it's just 600 megs. Well, try reading that. Try reading through that by hand. It's not fun. You know, uphill both ways in the snow. So, yeah, so a lot of the reason that the larger end cluster systems, and anybody who really cares about security, BusyBox and UC Libsy both support SE Linux. Why? Because the security nuts love it. Because they've read through and understood every line. And they're happy with that. So, when we talk about embedded systems, there's a set of problems that people are attempting to solve. Energy efficiency, memory efficiency, complexity and security, and dealing with non-standard user interfaces. Your Linksys router, the user interface is a web page. Because it doesn't have a monitor, it doesn't have a keyboard, it's got to do everything through CGI. That's how you configure the system. That's actually fairly common for something that's networked. You just have to make sure that your CGIs are sufficiently secure, but at least that's a semi-known problem. Some of these don't have network access in the same way. I mean, your cell phone isn't something you normally telnet to. It does have a screen, but it has a small... I'd show you my cell phone, but it's in the room charging.
Because we've all never seen a cell phone before.
Yeah. It does have a screen, but it has a small screen. You can't put a standard, like, GNOME display on that or something. And it doesn't usually have a full keyboard. It has maybe a little joystick pad or something that you can use. So you have to design different user interfaces for these kind of things. And there are a number of people who do. QT, the people who make the toolkit behind KDE, they have QT embedded. It's one of their big cash cows. It's the QT toolkit for use in embedded systems.
It stripped out the need to have an X server, works directly with the frame buffer or a few other pieces of hardware. They're able to shrink the entire stack for GUI down by about 75% with the exact same API functionality.
But it's written in C++. Ooh, what will they use for the standard C++ library?
Well, if they would listen to my emails, they'd use my software. I know I can actually get KDE to compile against it.
A lot of their customers use his software.
That's true. Which, once again, scares me to no end. But the other thing, too, is that...
It's always weird when software you've worked on is deployed in something you don't know how to do.
Yeah, now nuclear reactors. The other thing, too, is that as processor, the amount of processing power you can get in an embedded system, memory-constrained embedded system has gone up. Same with... memory and whatnot, so we're talking in this case cell phones and whatnot, we're able to go to higher and higher languages. Originally assembler, C, C++, some Python, some Perl. And so what we're
Java.
Getting, and what we're able to do is we're able to get much better value out of developers by doing that. So there's a big business case there. To be going to more powered systems, just simply because, as we stated originally, you're able to get your developers to do much more, right? So writing something in Qt, if anybody here has used it, it has the best documentation of any software library I have ever used. It makes it a lot easier for people to develop applications.
Okay, let's diverge quickly into what a small Linux system has in it. Okay, I have a project called Firmware Linux. That one of the things that we did when we were at TimeSys was cross-compiling. Because when you have an ARM little cell phone or something, you generally don't develop on an ARM system. You don't have an ARM desktop. You have an Intel desktop. So, and usually a lot of these little systems, yeah, they're fairly powerful, but you really don't want to try to compile software on something that has, 16 megs in it, or 64 megs of RAM and a 233 megahertz processor. It's not going to... Try compiling the Linux kernel under that these days. It's going to be a little unhappy.
GCC doesn't like that.
GCC takes 400 megabytes to recompile itself. GCC is kind of evil.
We could swap over the network.
There are people who use NFS root mounts and swap over the network, and I could go into the bugs this introduces. Combining make with NFS's caching behavior in regards to timestamps. Don't. Just don't. We were paid money to debug things for people who did this.
It's good money.
Yeah.
You don't sleep at night, though.
Don't go there.
Don't go there.
Basically what you do is you cross-compile from an Intel system to produce an image that you load into the ARM device. Cross-compiling sucks. Cross-compiling sucks rocks. Don't go there either. The problem with cross-compiling is that the standard way you compile something is configure, make install. Backup. Configure. Ask a whole bunch of questions about the system you're building on so you'll know what to build. We're already into a deep fundamental design flaw. We're not building for the system we're building on. So everything configure does is wrong by design. It gets worse, but I think you have the general idea. Cross-compiling is hard. There's also two contexts. There's the host compiler and the target compiler. So anytime you have to build something that's going to, pre-process a file to produce a .h file, generating a file that you will then compile, that has to run on the host. But everything you build to deploy in the target has to be ARM code or MIPS code or something. So you need a compiler to produce x86 code, and you need a compiler that can produce ARM code, and your build process has to know when to use each one.
And hope configure doesn't try to proc CPU info.
You don't want to look at anything under proc. You don't want to look at anything under sys. You don't want to look at uname. You don't necessarily want to look at your environment variables. Make can get totally confused. If you ever try... Okay, GCC. I could go on a rant about GCC for all of our remaining time and then some, and I will try to restrain myself. But briefly, your include paths. Where does GCC find its header files? GCC has five different theories about where it may have installed your header files. It installed them. It doesn't know where they are. Run it under strace sometime if you... Don't do this right after eating. It looks at spec files. It looks... Spec files are a language it invented because its first three attempts were insufficient. And then they decided spec files were a bad idea, so they hardwired a spec file into GCC. But they still look on the file system to see if there's any extra spec files to override the one that's hardwired into the compiler. It looks at environment variables. It has some paths hardwired into the C code in something called Collect2, the job of which is to sit between GCC and LD and screw stuff up. He says it has something to do with C++.
I think
he has a theory.
I think it's responsible for trying to find in all of the objects that need to be instantiated at first when execution starts. I think, but I've thrown up so many times trying to go through and figure out how GCC handles C++ code that I've given up, and I'm hoping he'll fix it.
I am never signing over my copyrights to the Free Software Foundation, so they're never taking a patch from me. Anyway, trying to have a cross-compiler means you have a host compiler that has all the includes and all of the libraries it's linking against installed at known paths. You know, user includes, /lib/userlib, those are taken with x86 stuff. Your cross-compiler, they have to live somewhere else. But convincing GCC not to look in the standard places, even as a fallback, is kind of hard.
There was a case, I think, you and I were trying to work on just setting up a test system, and we said, okay, install everything into my home directory under, you know, /gcc cross or whatever. And it was trying to find include files, and it would check inside the directory. It checked every location possible except for the location we told it to build the files into. It checked several subdirectories. It checked backing out two directories and into user lib. Oh, three directories and into user lib. I think it checked nine different directories, and not one of them was the one that we told it in three separate locations to install and check.
I once decided that I am going to rip out their five different attempts at doing path logic, because every time they give up on the previous attempt at path logic, they never rip it out, they just write another one. You know, to hope it finds it first and then fall back to the other one if that didn't work. They now have five. I decided I was going to rip them all out and write one that worked. My patch got to ripping out 10,000 lines of code, and the end still wasn't in sight, and that's the point at which I gave up and wrote a wrapper script that you call instead of GCC. It parses your command line that you're going to feed to GCC, inserts no standard inc, no standard lib, and tells it explicitly, here's where the damn things are, and then gives it the rest of the command line.
Why is it that...
Technically, I wrote a sixth layer, but it's not part of GCC.
Why is it that every embedded project involving GCC starts off with a wrapper script designed to avoid having GCC do anything that GCC actually does?
Anyway, cross-compiling is hard. So you don't want to do it. What you want to do these days is cross-compile as little as possible and do so with packages that have been tested for cross-compiling before, because most packages aren't interested in cross-compiling. They are interested in, oh yes, this builds and runs on ARM, here's a patch that fixes something on ARM, you got the endianness wrong or you got the word size wrong or something, everybody will take patches on that. But when I built it on my Red Hat system for ARM, it didn't work. They're going, nobody wants to take patches about cross-compiling unless they already do it. So you take, I found the smallest number of packages I found was 7 packages that can make a little native build environment. So you build a cross-compiler, which is hard. you use the cross-compiler to cross-compile these 7 packages that are known to be cross-compiler friendly, meaning they'll only break about 5 given times. And then you run the little native build environment under an emulator and build in that. Because your average Core Duo PC, it doesn't have a limited amount of storage space. Your hard drive is insanely large. It doesn't have a limited amount of memory, which are problems building natively on real hardware. It generally has so much processing power that, yes, your emulator is working at 1/5 native speed, but it's a dual 2 gigahertz 64-bit processor. We're okay with that. It's still way the heck faster than the 200 megahertz ARM system. And you don't have to deal with weird things like NFS and stuff. Building natively under emulation is the approach that I took in the Firmware Linux project. And it's an approach that TimeSys is working towards. Wind River has been sniffing at it. Part of what happened is that emulators have gotten way the heck better in the last few years, mostly to a project called QEMU. QEMU is written by a man named Fabrice Bellard. He's really, really smart, probably crazy, and French. Those last two statements. Anyway, yeah. He's also known, he wrote something called TinyCC, which started as an entry in the obfuscated C code contest. He wrote a compiler that compiled itself. He won best abuse of the rules. And then he unobfuscated it and turned it into a full C99 compiler. It's like, hey, that's cool. That was his previous project. His current project is actually, he took TCC and he broke off the back end that generates x86 code. It's just one program. There's no separate compiler and linker and assembler. It just, here's the input, produces the output. Which is how every compiler should work, by the way, but GCC doesn't. And I won't go into that rant because we don't have time. I'd like to save some time for questions.
I was just going to say, we've got about 12 minutes left. Do you want to start taking general questions?
At the 10-minute mark.
Okay.
Just finishing up the theory of how, if you're going to do embedded development on a non-x86 system, the point of this is cross-compile as little as possible because it hurts. This is the voice of experience. Do you agree? It hurts.
Yes.
It's an endless source of bugs. So what you want to do is throw hardware at the problem rather than throw engineering time at the problem. Get a compute cluster with distCC or something and get an emulator for your target environment and a native build environment for your target environment and build under that. And headless boxes aren't so bad if you can get SSH running, and there's a program called DropBear, which is a much smaller implementation of an SSH server. If you can get SSH running, then you can SSH into the box, so that's pretty good. If your emulator can fake a serial console, then you can usually get a console on standard in and standard out of the emulator, so you have a console you can talk to. That's, you know, and then just run screen and life is good. Native compiling under emulation is probably the way to go if you want to do that thing. Cross-compiling is a can of worms that the industry, I think, has largely outgrown but hasn't realized it yet.
Yeah, that sounds about right.
Okay, questions? There's 8 gazillion more things we can rant about. Yes, embedded development makes you angry. You had a question.
What kind of toys should we buy to play with?
First thing I would do is play with QEMU.
Yeah.
I would actually grab the emulator and start playing with that. The thing about physical hardware that's hard is it's not just Linux development. Okay, it's not that hard to get you need a root file system and a kernel image to boot. It's not that hard to get those. You can get those from Debian, you can get those from Gentoo, there's something called the Gentoo Embedded Project. You can get them from Firmware Linux, you can get them from a bunch of places. QEMU has a bunch of sample images you can use. But the hard part is your bootloader. Grub and Lilo are nothing compared to the bootloaders you will encounter on ARM and MIPS and stuff. They're not standardized. They're built into the firmware.
They're buggy.
They're really buggy. And the other fun thing is, a lot of these systems, you need something called a JTAG in order to upgrade them once you've accidentally turned them into a brick. It's very hard to brick an emulator. It's not that hard to brick a piece of physical equipment so that it's not listening to you anymore. It doesn't boot.
If you're looking for advice on a particular piece of hardware to look at, in terms of overall cost and general usefulness as an embedded system, I'd look at a GumStick stack. They're pretty cheap. I mean, you're looking somewhere in the $300 to $500 range.
Oh, you can get cheaper than that. The Linksys WRT54L.
Yes.
Linksys routers used to be Linux based, and then they went down to 2 megs of flash and either 4 or 8 megs of DRAM, and they went, oh, Linux can't fit in that. And the Linux community went, sure it can. And so we have managed to fit Linux on those things. The problem is that's what you need a JTAG for. A JTAG is a piece of equipment that essentially, it doesn't quite latch onto the chip and click onto all the pins, but it might as well. It clicks onto a little external port thing called a JTAG port. It's something that you hook up to your computer and feed data into the chip directly without the device actually being on. It's a little bit like an EEPROM burner. You reflash the flash while the thing is off, and then you switch it on and hope it boots.
It's like running GDB on the system at the hardware level. You can poke in and do weird things at registers depending upon the system.
It kind of sucks. One of the nice things about...
It sucks less than not having it at all.
It sucks less than it staying a brick.
So if you can find one of the Linksys boxes that you can run Linux on,
you can still buy them new. They're 3 times the price of a normal Linksys, but they're still under $100.
Yeah.
And you can also find the older ones from before they, you know, this was not Linksys being evil. This was Linksys being cheap bastards. One of the things you learn to distinguish, you know, it's like, oh, the binary-only firmware, these people are being evil because they have binary-only firmware. No, some of them are just being too cheap to buy a ROM. You know, they can get a 16-meg DRAM and they only need 8 to run the device, so when the device first comes up, you load the firmware into it, and it runs off the device. Those guys aren't actually being evil, they're just being too cheap to buy a ROM. Some of them are being evil. But you learn to distinguish these once you've looked at it a bit.
Okay. Does that answer your question?
Linksys, GumSticks.
Yeah. Good choices.
There's several others. There's a project called OpenWRT that had a panel earlier that, you know, they can give you some example hardware that they run stuff on. I mentioned Gentoo Embedded. They have an IRC channel on Freenode. They've got a website, embedded.gentoo.com. There's a bunch of expertise there if you want to ask them.
At a certain point, it starts becoming application specific too. So, if you just want something to play with, there are a lot of
project OSD, which is a media player using Linux.
Yeah, the first thing you want to do with a given embedded system is boot up. You know, boot in a NitRamFS with BusyBox, get a shell prompt, and that means your kernel is running. That means your C library is running, and that means your user space is running, and that Dev Console is talking to you. And you know, that's actually a fairly large amount of stuff to get working. But you want to get that working before you worry about the drivers for the various hardware you're going to be talking to. The drivers for the various hardware you're going to be talking to is actually where the embedded people spend most of their time these days. Because rather than just send patches back to the kernel, they all want to do it with binary-only modules and keep it to themselves. And Thomas Gleixner just had a... kind of thing at Consumer Electronic Linux Forum. If any of you follow Linux Weekly News, you can read his rant. It's entirely justified. One of the things about the embedded market is that they're used to... You can't make a toaster these days without violating 50 patents. So what they actually do is the big embedded companies own smaller embedded companies that own smaller embedded companies, and after a few shell companies, you get to the companies that actually make something. They will make... Well, a lot of them, the ones out of Taiwan and Korea stuff, will make a production run of inventory, sell it out to distributors, and go bankrupt, or just fold. And then the company above them folds and stuff. And then by the time it gets out and actually is sold, the company that makes it has gone away. And anybody who wants to sue them over patent infringement now has about 3 years of legal forensics to figure out who it is they're actually suing, and it's usually some big company somewhere that I won't name because I don't want to get sued. But they do this, and you know, and by this time they've already started new companies to do the next generation, and the engineers have been fired and rehired. Ooh.
I think there was another gentleman back here that wanted to ask.
But this is to protect themselves from patents.
Yeah.
Now try to get these guys to deal with the terms of the GPL. Try to find them. They don't speak English. You know, there's some problems.
You had a question back there, sir?
Yes, great.
Oh, okay.
Okay. One of the nice things about doing embedded software is you can read through, you know, the BusyBox implementation of blah in an afternoon. You know, it's small, it's fairly self-contained, you're going to have to read a few man pages, but you can go...
F-S-C-K.
But, well, okay, that one sucks. there's a difference between... I don't work on BusyBox anymore, I have one called ToyBox where I'm re-implementing everything from scratch because I'm weird. But there's a difference between, oh, we wrote a new applet from scratch with small and simple in mind, and, oh, we grabbed an external project, chopped off about a third of it, nailed it to the side, and painted BusyBox on it, and, ooh, we're done, and it's 200K. The whole of BusyBox is less than a megabyte. The EXT2, the Makey2FS thing, is like 165K in a project that the whole of it is less than a megabyte, and all it does is write some data into a disk file. It's not brain surgery. FSCheck isn't brain surgery. It has several bad applications that actually Dennis Lozenko, the new maintainer, has done some good work about cleaning up. He's taken a chainsaw and a weed whacker to whole lots of it.
Did you take that patch where I ripped out 10,000 lines?
I sent it on to him. I mean, keep in mind that was most of a year ago now.
That's true.
It moves pretty fast. But it's small enough that if you want to understand how they implemented mount, it's 500 lines. You can read it in 4 hours and understand what it does. You usually can't do that with a lot of the larger ones. You know, you have to take a weekend to try to tackle if you really want to read this thing. But the embedded software is designed to be simple. And if you can find a way to simplify it more, they're happy. Okay? You get to the point where there's a certain amount of tension between I could make it simpler and I could make it smaller. Sometimes you can do a fancy trick that will save you 5 bytes at the cost of making it unreadable. And something we learned along the way is waste the 5 bytes so we can read it, please.
There's the joke about software development. The first 90% of a project takes 90% of the time, and the remaining 10% takes 90%
of the
time.
Takes the other 90%, yeah.
And that's one of the things that is... When you start dealing with features in software, too, a lot of times adding that one more feature will make large amounts of code unreadable, and by simply going through and eliminating some of the lesser-used features, you're able
Cat
to get...
Cat-V.
I'm afraid to ask.
It escapes everything so that every character printed is a visible character.
Oh.
Why is Cat doing this? I don't know.
It came back from Berkeley with flags.
Yes, yeah. It did.
It's Berkeley.
You pick up all sorts of things wandering through Berkeley.
So by taking the embedded software approach, we're getting software that generally tends to be faster because you've got on-die cache now in processors, so you've got faster. You've got smaller, obviously, because you're taking up less binary space. You've got more reliable and more secure and more auditable. The last three go together.
Yeah, something really quick. It's about a 4,000 cycle hit to go out of L1 and L2 cache to make a reference to main memory into a DRAM bank that you have to open. Which means that if you can stay in L1 cache doing something that's 5 times slower, you win. You know, it seems like it's so much slower to do it this way, but it stays in cache versus the you know, fancy, fast algorithm that has to go out to DRAM.
Not even that. I mean, if you look at a lot of old school programming books, they talk about loop unrolling as an optimization technique.
It used to be.
I mean, if you have if the compiler can detect that it's going to do something five times all of the time in a loop that you've coded, what it would do is it would unroll and duplicate the code five times, which, if you didn't have to deal with the caching issue, it was faster because you didn't have to do the comparison and jump instruction. Nowadays, you put that into cache, and you're getting three orders of magnitude improvement on something that is 10% slower.
Yeah, I mean, optimization is something that you could spend a whole panel on. These days, branch prediction, inserting bubbles into the pipeline, and DRAM fetch stalls are where all your performance hits go. Things like, in order to be really nice to branch prediction, rather than actually doing a branch, you do a conditional assignment, so that you calculate the value either way, and then what the test is on, it isn't on a jump, the test is on, do I actually do the assignment, or is the assignment a no-op? And if the compiler can redo things that way, that's one less branch it has to predict. And mispredicting branches is a huge performance penalty on the way modern processors are doing, because they break the pipeline down into a bunch of stages, and it's working on the next, you know, it's working five instructions ahead. It's decoding that bit before it's actually retired the instruction five or seven, or the Pentium 4 had like 17, but the Pentium 4 was evil. Won't go there, but processor architecture changes. Not just from processor to processor, it changes from generation to generation. So trying to optimize for something specific, you know, it's faster to pre-calculate all these values and keep them in a table, that was faster for that generation of hardware, it's now slower for this one. One of the nice things about simple is you unload all this crap on the compiler, and then it's its job to figure out what this generation of hardware needs. Okay. Final questions. Okay. Well, thank you.